bench, I'm sorry, when you approach the podium, please do state your name and your attorney registration number. And with that, let's proceed with People versus Templeton.
May it please the court, my name is Sean C. Thompson, registration number 40067, here on behalf of the defendant appellant James Templeton. I've raised several issues in my opening brief, each of which present independent grounds for reversal. What I want to discuss today, however, is how those trial issues led the jury to convict despite insufficient evidence. Looking to the totality of the circumstances of this case, how the errors multiplied each other, it becomes clear that Mr. Templeton's conviction was a result of the prejudicial effects that those errors must have had on the jury. Those errors were certainly harmful to Mr. Templeton's case. The evidence against Mr. Templeton was insufficient to convict. Mr. Templeton would not have been convicted, but for the respective misconduct of the victim and the prosecution and the trial court's refusal to provide adequate remedies for those instances of misconduct. The only evidence against Mr. Templeton in this case was Ms. Medina's testimony that he had called her and made a threatening statement. Conviction of stalking requires proof that the defendant made a credible threat to a person, but it also requires proof that in connection with that threat, the defendant repeatedly followed, approached, contacted, or placed that person under surveillance. It's conceded there was no direct evidence of any repeated following, approaching, contacting, or surveillance. Instead, the prosecution urged, and the Attorney General now reiterates, that the phone call proved both the credible threat and the repeating surveillance elements. Specifically, they argue that Mr. Templeton's alleged statement that he watched Ms. Medina, quote, every night, combined with his apparent knowledge of facts that might be gained through surveillance, was sufficient to show that he did what he allegedly said he did. As I argue in my briefs, a defendant's supposed secondhand confession to an offense standing alone is insufficient to convict.
Pardon me for interrupting, counsel, if I may, please.
Sure.
I want to talk a little bit about your argument that the statement that your client made over the telephone was a confession. Would you agree with me that we basically have two purposes for the corpus delicti rule in Colorado? The first is we have to show an injury that is penally prescribed, and second, that the unlawfulness of some person's conduct caused that injury. Would you agree with that?
Well, the corpus delicti rule is also to establish that a crime has indeed occurred.
Right. I'm quoting from one of the cases, that Supreme Court cases that was cited in one of the Court of Appeals cases that you relied on. This is People versus Smith.
Okay.
But nonetheless, let's assume that to establish that this is not a fantasy or a product of police and misconduct, but indeed a real crime. In this case, one of the elements, as you point out, was that the prosecution was required to prove that there was a credible threat, right?
Yes.
In that regard, isn't the defendant's statement saying that your baby's not going to make it, isn't that the credible threat and thus the element of the crime itself?
That is true. If the jury was to believe Ms. Medina's recollection of her,
okay,
what Mr. Templeton said, that would be an element of the crime.
If that's so, if that actually is part of the crime, as opposed to a statement afterwards, this is what I told her, or a statement beforehand, this is what I intend to do, but the statement then was part of the crime, then doesn't that statement, and part of determining whether it's credible, has to do with her pregnancy, the sex of the baby, and the color of the car, then doesn't that statement, that part of the crime now proved, doesn't that satisfy the corpus delicti rule? Because it shows that there was an unlawful crime, i.e. this threat, and secondly, somebody caused the injury. The injury was the threat.
Well, the crime is not constituted by a threat alone. That might be harassment or something, some other offense, but the crime of stalking also requires some sort of stalking behavior, which is specified in the statute. So I don't agree that the corpus delicti is proven by the fact of a credible threat alone.
All right, let me take it one last step. if indeed this is the threat, is the element of the crime itself, then it's neither an admission nor a confession. It's the element of the crime. And if that's so, isn't it that part of the statement adequate corroboration in and of itself of the other part, I've been watching you every night? Because it's not an admission and not a confession.
No, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has held in People v. Rankin that you can't have a confession that corroborates itself. The way that they look
at it... But counsel, I guess my point is, if it's not a confession, you don't have that problem.
Well, I don't agree that it's a confession as well. In fact, I'm not conceding that Mr. Templeton even made this phone call. There was no record support. The police didn't check phone records or anything of that nature. I'm saying that if it was...
I understand that, but Ms. Medina testified that he did, and the jury found him guilty, so...
Sure. If it is conceived of as an admission of some sort of behavior, there's nothing to corroborate that so-called admission. External to the admission itself, in the supposedly the details that are correct, that supposedly makes this admission self-corroborating. That
let me ask it in a little bit different way. In this situation, the defendant is actually making the threat during the phone call. It's not as if he were confessing to a police officer and saying, "I made a credible threat at some other point in time."
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so that's why I think Judge Menard is distinguishing the credible threat portion of the phone call from the confession portion, which provided details of the surveillance. You see the distinction?
Yes, but I'm not sure it makes any difference in terms of how, whether or not there was actually evidence of this other element of the offense, which is repeated surveillance in this case, is apparently what's being alleged.
But don't you just have to have evidence of some part of the actual offense apart from the confession portion to satisfy the corpus delicti rule?
Well, if you don't see this as a corpus delicti problem, it's still a sufficiency of the evidence problem. That the only proof of these other elements of the crime are what is apparently the defendant's statement to the victim that he was doing this. There is nothing other than that alleged statement, which I'm saying is tantamount to a confession if believed, or which they are saying is tantamount to a confession if believed, to corroborate that. And People v. Rankin, the court said that you cannot have a confession without some evidence external to that confession to support it. The way they analyzed the issue was they looked at what the evidence would be if the confession was subtracted from the body of evidence. In that case, they found nothing, and they decided that there was not enough evidence to support the conviction. The same thing was true here. The prosecution and the attorney general both say that the evidence that proves all elements of the offense came within this one 30-second phone call. Absent that 30-second phone call and that confession, contained therein, there's nothing to support the other elements of the offense, the repeated surveillance element.
So you don't think it's possible to partition the phone call into a confession portion and a actual threat portion?
It was two sentences. I don't think you can partition that out.
What about the actual facts? We know that this lady was in fact pregnant with a girl and that she drove a vehicle that was silver gray.
Certainly.
So that corroborated at least some of the information in the telephone call, correct?
Well, that's not information that needs to be gained from surveillance or repeated surveillance. And again, there's the rule that you cannot use the confession itself to corroborate itself. The fact that
I'm asking about whether there's other evidence that corroborates the confession, and the actual facts corroborate the confession.
Well, that Ms. Medina said that Mr. Templeton said things that that she knew to be true. I don't see that as correct.
We know them to be true because they're in the record and they were established by other testimony at trial, correct? So my question to you is, what did every single element of the crime of stalking have to be corroborated aside from the telephone call itself by either actual facts?
My argument
or
is
something
that
else?
Is that the offense is not completed. The offense of stalking is not completed unless all of the elements are shown, and if there's nothing to corroborate that the second part of the actual body of the repeated surveillance element is not proven by anything other than an alleged confession that he did it.
What about the case law that says the corroboration can be slight?
But it needs to be independent and external.
Well, the actual facts are independent and external. The actual fact that she was pregnant, that she was pregnant with a little girl, and that she actually drove a vehicle that was similar to what was described in the call, those are corroborative facts, no?
I disagree, but I think that, you know, that those are part of the confession. If I could continue on to part of the rest of my argument. Ms. Medina violated the court's order against 404B evidence coming in, and she did so by alleging that facts that were not even true. The jury heard that Mr. Templeton had, quote, stalked and harassed her on a prior occasion and been incarcerated. Mr. Templeton had never stalked and harassed Ms. Medina before. The alleged 404B incident dealt with some sort of prior altercation at a bar, and he ultimately pled guilty to attempted criminal trespass for that incident. The court found it could not even find by preponderance of the evidence what had actually occurred. So due to the Ms. Medina's violation, the jury heard inaccurate and even false allegations that he committed the same offense against the same victim. In the Supreme Court case Goldsberry, when reference is made in the presence of the jury to prior criminal acts that were previously deemed inadmissible, mistrial was normally required. And that's especially so where the evidence of guilt is not overwhelming and proof of at least one of the essential elements of the crime is entirely circumstantial, as here.
Pardon me for interrupting again, Mr. Thompson, but wasn't there a very thorough effort by the trial court to instruct the jury to disregard and in fact to have this witness start all over from the beginning?
That's true, but in Goldsberry the court says that where the evidence is not overwhelming and where one of the elements is proven by circumstantial evidence, a curative instruction cannot suffice. They say that
this was more than a curative instruction. All of her testimony after "what is your name, my name is" was stricken.
That's true. But the risk that the jury cannot or will not follow the instruction to disregard is so great and the consequence of the failure is so vital to the defendant that the court wrote, the practical and human limitations of the jury system cannot be ignored. So in these circumstances, a curative instruction is not a sufficient remedy. Regardless of whether or not you think the corpus delicti is shown, the fact of the matter is that we have an entire stalking entire stalking offense wherein the entire body of evidence is a single phone call, and the jury is asked to infer that he must have known these facts from stalking because these facts were indeed true. Now, that is proof entirely by circumstantial evidence on one of the elements of the crime. The court itself noted that it was passing the case to the jury on a motion of judgment for judgment of acquittal on the thinnest margin imaginable. I believe is what she said. So this is a case where a curative instruction to the jury to disregard that the same defendant had committed the same offense against the same victim on a previous occasion could not be followed. This is exactly the type of thing that requires mistrial because it's impossible for the defendant to get a fair trial under those circumstances. So a mistrial was required and a curative instruction was not sufficient to cure that prejudice. I see I'm running short on time. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Yes, you may, Mr. Thompson. You have a little less than a minute 40 remaining.
May it please the court, my name is Ryan Crane, attorney registration number 37842, and I represent the people in this case. To jump right in, the defendant's corpus delicti argument is something like the following. All he did was make a phone call, and there's nothing else to corroborate that he did anything that he said in the phone call. His argument might have some traction if the call had gone something like, hello, this is me, I'm going to hurt you, and by the way, I'm following you every day, everywhere you go. And if it was a phone number that Ms. Medina had had, sorry, that the victim had had prior to the time when they broke up several years previously, and if it had been at a place, not at her place of work, and if he hadn't referenced the fact that she was pregnant with a girl and this car that she didn't drive at the time that they broke up several years before. In that case, his argument might have some traction. But here, all of those factors, all those facts, as the court noted, confirm and provide slight evidence, some corroboration, circumstantial in nature, that corroborate his confession on the phone, the confession portion of his call. I think that's a good way to analyze the call, that he was in fact surveilling her directly or indirectly, as the statute allows, at some point during that time, seeing her walk out to a gray car every night.
Mr. Crane, pardon me for interrupting, but would you respond to my question that is this a corpus delicti issue at all, considering that the statement, the threat portion of the statement, was part of the crime, and thus isn't it an admission or a confession? Would you respond to that?
I think the distinction that Judge Boris brought up about distinguishing between a threat portion of the call and a confession portion of the call, I think that's a good way to look at it. The fact that the call was 30 seconds or however many sentences it was, I don't think that plays into it. But indeed, the fact when he said the baby ain't going to make it, that was a credible threat. And when he said, I'm watching you every night do this, 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 and this, that corroborated his admission to following her. Does that answer the question?
I suppose. Go ahead.
I don't think that the fact that part of the call was an element of the offense, I don't think that necessarily negates the application of the corpus delicti problem. But
let me ask you a little question about the way corpus delicti works in general. Okay, from my research, I found sort of two different ways it works depending on the jurisdiction. And one way is that if there is a confession to a crime, there has to be at least some element of the crime established by independent evidence. And then there are other jurisdictions that take a lightened rule where they say if there's enough corroboration of details to make it a trustworthy confession, in fact, some have gone so far to change corpus delicti to trustworthiness rule, mm-hmm. then that's sufficient. And so I'm wondering what your view is about how the rule works in Colorado, especially since we have Rankin, which is rather old, and it sort of deals with it in passing, but it talks about looking at evidence outside of the confession.
Rankin, the way I read it was, here's my notes. Rankin seemed to me to not really be a corpus delicti issue, quite honestly. It seemed more like a sufficiency of the evidence case, because the issue there was the defendant had given a piece of blotter paper to someone or dissolved it in some water, and also some other blotter paper from other people had been dissolved in some water, and the victim drank it or somehow ingested the water or whatever it was, the liquid, and later became ill. The problem in that case, as I read it, is our Supreme Court found that there was no actual evidence from any expert or anyone besides what the defendant said that the chemical that he added to that liquid was LSD. And so to me, that seems like a traditional sufficiency of the evidence claim. And I see the corpus delicti sort of flavor to it, but to me it seemed a little bit distinct. I did look at the Smith case, and in that case, the court seemed to say, well, it used the phrase sufficiency of the evidence and corpus delicti in the same introductory paragraph. And so the way I read it, the way our state has applied the rule, is corpus delicti is essentially a type of sufficiency of the evidence argument, and maybe even a specific rule within a sufficiency of the evidence framework. I am aware that federal courts do not apply the rule in that manner, and there's been some discussion among them as to whether it's an admissibility rule or a sufficiency of the evidence rule. It looks like the circuits have treated it a little bit differently, and the Supreme Court in the 50s, I think, got rid of the rule in to begin with, but they still sort of analyze it as a sufficiency issue sometimes, from what I read. Thank you. The defendant's other argument with relation to the victim's statements at trial, I disagree that the jury was unable to follow the trial court's curative instruction, and I certainly disagree that it was an abuse of discretion that can be reversed on appeal for the trial court to rely on the curative instruction it used. As the court noted, the trial court's curative instruction did go beyond a regular curative instruction. It was extremely thorough. I think it was, I don't know how much transcript pages it took up, but it was several paragraphs, at least when I quoted it in the brief, and the court went to extreme lengths to say, you know, I recognize it's sometimes difficult for ordinary people to set aside, you know, things they've heard, but that's the way we do it in court, and I respect you as you know, jurors. I know you can do this. I'm asking you to do it. And the court, of course, took that additional step that I noted of saying the truth of the things you heard before, just know that they're not known. It's a pretty prejudicial statement, actually, to the prosecution to tell the jury, by the way, the witness presenting essentially the entire case, the truth of her statements are not known. And that was, of course, directly after she had said he was incarcerated and things of that nature. I'm assuming a jury would have said, if they were to follow the instruction at all, they would have held it against the prosecution's witness and said, well, gosh, she's saying all these weird things. And the trial court even noting the victim's, quote, insolent demeanor. I mean, it's not a great case for the prosecution in that sense. And so the jury was able to take those things into account. They saw what was going on. The trial court also saw what was going on and judged her demeanor, its effect on the jury, and the way her statements were understood. I think we have to defer to the trial court in this case. We can't say that it was arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair for the trial court to rely on this instruction. The court heard the arguments of counsel at length out of the presence of the jury and put its reasoning and observations carefully on the record before giving this lengthy curative instruction. And I will also point out again, as I did in the brief, that the trial court found, based on its observation of the witness's testimony, that when she referred to stalking and harassing behavior previously by the defendant when they had broken up, she was not referring to convictions of crimes. She was referring to a general tenor of the relationship, is the phrase that the trial court used. But she was using those phrases in their colloquial sense, and the jury would not have understood them as prior convictions. Happy to answer any other questions, but if the
I have one, Mr. Crane. Yes, is it your understanding that corroboration is required of every element of the crime?
You know, I think that's an interesting question. I couldn't find anything on point when I was researching it. I'll agree with a sentiment I heard expressed from I think Judge Bernard earlier, and that's and I think defense counsel even mentioned it, but that's it would seem that you would at least need some kind of corroborative evidence that the crime at issue occurred. And what I mean is, if stalking is comprised of a credible threat and in connection therewith the contact or surveillance, it seems like if all you had was something to corroborate a threat, that you might have a corpus delicti for, as he mentioned, harassment by telephone or something of that nature. But I think that it makes sense that you would need some sort of corroboration that the crime of conviction occurred. It obviously doesn't need to be, I don't think it even needs to meet the traditional sufficiency of the evidence test. It can be very slight, but I think you would need something on which to determine that there's something to say that this crime occurred, not just that a crime occurred.
Why is the corroboration sufficient here?
Well, the corroboration is sufficient because the fact that he knew, you know, had found out and had no other good reason to know now, several years after they had broken up, her new phone number, place of work, the time that she left work every night, the color of the car that she stepped into every night, and the fact that she was pregnant with a girl, that's sufficient for us to corroborate his own statement that he was watching her do so every night. And the fact that So those facts corroborate his statement. I'd like to thank the court for its time and ask that the judgment of conviction be affirmed.
To jump right in, I'd like to discuss Rankin. In that case, the confession in the, there was the defendant said that he had a substance that was LSD. It was distributed, and a person actually took it and became ill from taking it. The doctor said that the sickness was consistent with LSD, but was not, you know, necessarily LSD. To answer your question, Judge Terry, you know, that could be seen as corroboration of some fact. There was some fact external to the confession that proved that this was possibly true, that the confession was possibly true. But the court said it wasn't enough. You need to show that the confession, more than just that it could be true, it needs to show that the, you know, it needs to be show more. So they said that that was not corroborative. The same thing is true in this case where, you know, you may have these other facts which happen to be true, but that doesn't mean that those facts were necessarily learned through surveillance and, importantly, through repeated surveillance. So the fact that this could be true and the fact that the confession shows that it might be true is not enough to corroborate the confession and provide enough support for a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. Again, the curative instruction that the judge concluded saying the truth of the things said are unknown, well, that is actually cuts the other way, in my opinion, because the facts of what Ms. Medina said were, the truth of those were known. Mr. Templeton was not convicted of stalking and harassing. He was not incarcerated for that. And that is the implication that she said. She said, he was stalking and harassing me, and he was incarcerated. A jury would certainly conclude between those two statements that he was stalking and harassing her and was incarcerated as a result of a conviction for that offense. So with that, I would ask the court to vacate or at the very least reverse Mr. Templeton's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your arguments, counsel. We appreciate them very much. And the case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. And when counsel table are cleared, counsel may set up for the next argument.